we're now entering a period where the millennial kingdom is going to start in the book of Zechariah. There will be a slight departure from that next week, where there will be a little bit of a parenthetical regression, if you will, back to the Great Tribulation, just to provide one more piece of information about its intensity. But by and large, this chapter is about the great times that are coming, the wonderful blessings that are coming on this earth. And if you look at your notes there, I put Zechariah 14, verses 6 to 11. Well, it's actually 6 to 9. I apologize for the typo. I was going to have those last two verses in there, but by the time I got done writing, I had enough material. So figured next week. So let's look at Zechariah in chapter 14, verses 6 to 9, where the Lord says, "And it shall come to pass in that day that there shall not be light. The bright ones shall withdraw themselves, but it shall be one day which is known unto Jehovah, not day and not night, but it shall come to pass that at evening time there shall be light. And it shall come to pass in that day that living waters shall go out from Jerusalem, half of them towards the eastern sea and half of them towards the western sea. In summer and in winter shall it be, and Jehovah shall be king over all the earth. In that day shall Jehovah be one, and his name one." Now, as our custom, we're going to go over this in sections, and there's three big sections here. The first one is the absence of natural light for a period at the beginning of the millennial kingdom. And it's important for us to think about this as we go through this, that this is not the first time, or will not be the first time, that this has happened. God marks significant events with the absence of light. Significant events, and we're going to look at a few of those. So the first two verses in our passage are 6 and 7 from chapter 14, and they say, "And it shall come to pass in that day that there shall not be light. The bright ones shall withdraw themselves, but it shall be one day, which is known unto Jehovah, not day and not night, but it shall come to pass that at evening time there shall be light." Now, these massive changes that are coming on the earth, some of which occurred during the Great Tribulation, causing shifts in the geological formations. The highest mountain in the world is now going to be at Jerusalem, the Temple Mount. It's going to be a mountain that's 50 miles, the top of it is going to be 50 miles square. And that's going to be the highest mountain in the world. There's going to be massive changes in the topography and the temperature and the speed of light and the government. It's a series of changes that we're going to look at over the next few weeks that we can't even imagine, because we live here in time and space with physics of the speed of light and the speed of electricity and the temperature and the tilt of the earth and so on and the weather patterns that we just kind of think are the way things always been. And there is what's taught through evolution, which is in all the schools now, is this concept of uniformitarianism, which states that the way things are now are the way things have always been. But this is not the case. There really was a flood. There really were things that were enormously chaotic to this world. Enormously chaotic, and this is going to be one of them. So the descriptions that we're going to be looking at are going to be beginning right at the beginning of the millennial kingdom. This kingdom is coming. It is coming. Christ told his apostles, that we call the Lord's Prayer, but it's really the apostles' prayer. He told them, this is how you pray. And one of the things he said in Matthew 6 was, "Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven." This is going to be about as close, for this thousand-year period that's coming, about as close as we can get to being in heaven. And we'll see heaven. We will see heaven before we come back with him at the end of the great tribulation, because we will be raptured out before the tribulation. And we will have resurrected bodies when we come back. And we will be here to see the start of the millennial kingdom. Now, the text that we're looking at here in these two verses describes this period called the Day of the Lord. That is an Old Testament idiomatic, phrase for a time when God has control over the earth. And for those of you that were with me when we did the dispensations in the men's group, you know that that's the end of the church age. The end of the church age. God is going to take the earth back. And he's going to conduct this great tribulation that runs for 7 years. And then in our last session, we saw the 75-day interval and the few events that happened there. And now we're looking at the millennial kingdom, which follows that. That will last 1,000 years. 1,000 years. So that day, or the day of the Lord, the day of Jacob's trouble, there's a lot of different idiomatic phrases that are used in the Old Testament to describe this, but it is a period. God takes control. God takes control. Man no longer has control. We can't control it. We can't do a good job. Not like God can do. We will have a theocracy where Jesus, as we're going to see today, has been promised the throne of David, which will be at Jerusalem, and he will be living there for 1,000 years. So the evil influences which have controlled this world will be done. Will be done. They will not be influencing this world. So things are going to change. And the signal event at the beginning of the millennial kingdom is the removal of all light. I don't know if any of you have ever been in an environment where there's absolutely no light. It is scary. If you've ever been in one of the caverns, then you know what I'm talking about. But there's no way to be in an area of no light unless you were in a particularly sealed environment. And it is oppressive. It is oppressive. This has happened at least twice before, and it caused a major shift in world events, in God's economy. Not in the way we record history with wars and conquering and changes of political power and so on. No, the way God does things, it's with massive geological or geophysical changes that he controls to make a signal that I'm changing things. I'm changing things. For example, he caused darkness. It was second to the last plague. And during just before the Exodus, when he caused darkness to fall on the Egyptians, but he did not cause darkness to fall on the Jews. On the Jews. Now, this is in Exodus 10, verses 21 to 29. The darkness, the text says, was so black that they felt it. Try and think through. Let that soak in for a minute. The darkness was so dark, they felt it. Now, again, if you've ever been in one of these caverns where there is no light, it is oppressive. It's satanic. Satan lives where there is no light. God brings light. God is light. So these are things to consider here. This is going to be a significant event. God is going to cause all the light on the earth to be gone. And it's going to be done through the sun and the moon and the stars. Those are the items that will no longer give their light. Now, the second time this happened, it's happened more than once. I mean, there's a lot of blackouts that God brings during the tribulation, before the tribulation, and so on, for different purposes. But I'm just citing these two here as a reference point. The other one is the 3 hours before Christ died. All light was gone on the earth for 3 hours before Christ died. The sixth to the ninth hour. Matthew 27 tells us. The blackout that happened then brought the redemption of the world. It signaled the Redeemer had paid the punishment. The blackout that happened in the Exodus was the Paschal Lamb was going to come. The Passover was protecting them. The nation Israel, as prophesied, was coming out after 400 years in Egypt, a major event in God's economy. So this particular event here is signaling the beginning of the Messianic kingdom. Now, we don't know how long this one is going to last, because the text says that it may last for one day. It depends on how the context of that is formulated, and I've researched it, and it's just not clear. It may be only one day. It may only be one day. And if so, it begins to tell us that the light's going to come back on in an evening time. Not during the day, not during the night, but it's going to come back on in an evening, which will be even more spectacular. You'll go through a day, the normal time during the day, and it'll be continue to be black. And then all of a sudden, the light comes back on. And the light that comes back on for the millennial kingdom is seven times faster than the speed of light now. It's not in intensity. It's not that the light rays are faster or we're closer to the sun or something like that. We get burned up if it was just a light ray. No, it's the speed of light. The speed of light. He's reordering the earth. It's a renovation of the earth, and he's reordering even the physical capabilities and the physical concepts here. It is getting reordered. Look what Isaiah 30, verse 26 says. Moreover, the light of the moon shall be as the light of the sun. It's going to intensify. And the light of the sun shall be sevenfold as the light of 7 days in the day that Jehovah bindeth up the hurt of his people and healeth the stroke of their wound. So, the time that he heals their people is after the great tribulation. They've been punished. Now they're being healed because they've confessed that Jesus is the Messiah. The day that Jehovah bindeth up the hurt of his people and healeth the stroke of their wound. This is right after the great tribulation. Now they've been punished. The great tribulation is to punish them because they've rejected Jesus as their Messiah. You know, the velocity or the speed of light has been measured at least 164 times by 16 different astronomers and competent scientists for the last 500 years. And it's been found that the speed of light is decreasing. It's not perceptible to us, the naked eye, but it has been decreasing. And I put a few figures in your notes for consideration. It's been slowing down since the origin of the time, and we think it's been slowing down consistently since the origin of the time. We know it has for the last 500 years. One of those gentlemen was Romer. He observed this phenomena and did regression analysis, which is just trying to go back and figure out, well, if it slowed down this much for the last 70, 80 years since the last guy did this, what is that pattern going back? And he figured out that about the time of Christ, it was 10 to 30% faster. About the time of Solomon, which is 900 BC, it was two times faster. Back to Abraham, which is a little over 2300 BC, it was four times faster. And if you go all the way back to creation, it's at least 10 million times faster using a straight line regression analysis. You know, there may be differences in that regression. It may not be a straight linear regression, but it looks as if this is a competent analysis. Life is going to last a minimum of 100 years during the millennium. The person that dies young, and it will be a Gentile sinner that doesn't have a resurrected body, because there's going to be resurrected bodies when we come back. The Jews will be given resurrected bodies, and the Gentiles coming in to the millennial kingdom will come through the Great Tribulation. And we looked at last week, they'll be judged. The Valley of Jehoshaphat, and those that are deemed saved, categorized as sheep, they go in, but they have natural bodies. The youngest of those during the Great Tribulation that dies is going to be 100 years old. There is something causing the longevity of life in the millennial kingdom. Something caused the longevity of life in the early chapters of Genesis. When you have people living 800-900 years, there's a reason for that. And those lifespans gradually slowed down. So the analysis holds. Whether it is completely accurate or not, we don't know, because the regression analysis may have some flaws in it, but it may not be perfectly linear. It sure holds, though, because we know that there's going to be long life in the millennial kingdom. So something is going to be giving us much longer light. And during the millennial kingdom, the land is also going to be extremely well watered. It's going to produce an abundance of food because of the sevenfold increase in light. Now, the text states that, so it's reasonable to extrapolate that over to the bodies that we'll have. Well, not you and I, because we'll have resurrected bodies. Not going to pertain to those. But the natural bodies will have a longer life. If the plants are going to be in abundance, they're going to be in greater volume, and they're going to be in greater size and a longer life, it's reasonable to assume that because the speed will be significantly increased, that the food production and the life longevity is going to increase as well. Now, Isaiah 30, verses 23 to 26, expand on that. And I'm not going to go there today because that's another whole discussion we could have that would take me away from the text here, Zechariah. The next section of the passage that we started with is a discussion of what I call the millennial river. Now, this passage is coupled with several others to give us a richer description of what God is going to do on the millennial mountain, the 50 square mile mountain, and we're going to look at what's on that mountain, and we're going to look at where these rivers come from and what they do. Now, our text says, and it shall come to pass in that day, that living waters shall go out from Jerusalem, half of them towards the eastern sea, half of them towards the western sea, in summer and in winter shall it be. Now, there's three other passages that I want to go to, and then I'm going to repeat part of one of them because of the specific piece of information that I want to focus in on. The first is Ezekiel 47, verses 1 to 12. And we remember now, Ezekiel was a prophet who was carried away during the second Babylonian captivity of Israel. And that was in, the second one was in 597 B.C. Remember, there are three Babylonian captivities of the southern kingdom, 605 B.C., 597 B.C., and then the last one, which sacked everything, was 586 B.C. In 597, Nebuchadnezzar, as he did in the first invasion, took the choicest of the select people, the educated, the priesthood, and so on. And Ezekiel was one of those. Nebuchadnezzar in the first two invasions wasn't trying to harm Israel significantly. He was trying to warn them. But during that process, he thought he would take some of the best of the best. And he wanted those minds. He wanted those young guys and their strength and their willingness to learn to come in and help build up the Babylonian government. Well, it didn't work that way because these guys love God. Ezekiel loved God. Ezekiel had many, many prophecies during that time from 597 B.C. till 586, which is only 11 years. 11 years. And during that time, he had a significant number of prophecies about things that are yet future to us. Yet future to us. And this is one of them. Where our text here says, "And he," that's the Lord, "brought me back unto the door of the house," which is the temple, "and behold, waters issued out from under the threshold of the house eastward. For the forefront of the house was towards the east, and the waters came down from under, from the right side of the house on the south of the altar. Then he brought me out by the way of the gate northward, and led me round by the way without unto the outer gate, by the way of the gate that looketh towards the east. And behold, there ran out waters on the right side. When the man went forth eastward with the line in his hand, he measured 1,000 cubits. And he caused me to pass through the waters, waters that were to the ankles. Again, he measured 1,000 and caused me to pass through the waters, waters that were to the knees. Again, he measured 1,000 and caused me to pass through the waters, waters that were to the loins. Afterward, he measured 1,000, and it was a river that I could not pass through, for the waters were risen, waters to swim in, a river that could not be passed through. And he said unto me, Son of man, hast thou seen this? Then he brought me and caused me to return to the bank of the river. Now when I had returned, behold, upon the bank of the river were very many trees on the one side and on the other. Then he said unto me, These waters issue forth towards the eastern region and shall go down into the Arabah," that's the Dead Sea, "and they shall go towards the sea. Unto the sea shall the waters go which were made to issue forth, and the waters shall be healed. And it shall come to pass that every living creature which swarmeth in every place whither the rivers come shall live, and there shall be a very great multitude of fish, for these waters are come thither, and the waters of the sea shall be healed, and everything shall live whithersoever the river cometh. And it shall come to pass that fishers shall stand by it from En-Gedi even unto Engalim, shall be a place for the spreading of nets. Their fish shall be after their kinds, as the fish of the great sea, exceeding many. But the miry places thereof and the marshes thereof shall not be healed. They shall be given up to salt. And by the river upon the bank thereof, on this side and on that side, shall grow every tree for food, whose leaf shall not wither, neither shall the fruit thereof fail, for it shall bring forth new fruit every month, because the waters thereof issue out of the sanctuary, and the fruit thereof shall be for food, and the leaf thereof for healing." For healing. It's an abundance of produce because of the speed of light and because of these special waters that are going to emanate from the temple. They're going to emanate from the temple and turn into rivers. One side's going to go to the Arabah, which is the Dead Sea. And if anybody knows anything about the Dead Sea, you know that it is dead. There's nothing living in it. It's got the highest concentration of salt of any body of water in the world. It's way below sea level. I mean, it's a strange place, a very strange place. When we visited there, we didn't go in the water, but people that went in the water, you can't sink. Try as you might, you can't sink because the buoyancy of all the salt holds people up. It's really quite a phenomenon. That's all gone. That's done. The Dead Sea will no longer be dead. And the water is also going to go out to the Mediterranean. That's the Great Sea. Now, the second passage here that I want to touch on is from Joel, and it's basically just summarizing this. He's affirming it and he's summarizing it. Joel 3:18 says, "And it shall come to pass in that day that the mountains shall drop down sweet wine, and the hills shall flow with milk, and all the brooks of Judah shall flow with waters, and a fountain shall come forth from the house of Jehovah and shall water the valley of Shittim. The reason that God puts these statements in these multiple prophets so that out of the mouth of two or more witnesses the truth comes and we can validate it. These prophets, these books of the Bible were written by different people at different times under different circumstances, and most of them didn't know each other or know what the others had written. But it comes together and it validates what God said. You know, I'm listening to people that will say you can't prove the Bible with the Bible because it's circular reasoning. And that would be true if the Bible was one book. It's one binding with 66 books that were written by different authors, 40 different authors, over a period of 1,600 years. A lot of these guys never knew each other. They had a unique experience with God. So here's Joel and Ezekiel saying that this river is going to come out of the temple. And it's going to make its way south to the Dead Sea. Now I'm going to go back to just two verses from the Ezekiel passages where he's talking about its origin here. And he brought me back to the door of the house, and behold, waters issued out from under the threshold of the house eastward. For the forefront of the house was towards the east. And the waters came down from under, from the right side of the house, on the south of the altar. Then he brought me out by the way of the gate northward, and led me round by the way without unto the outer gate, by the way of the gate that looketh towards the east. And behold, there ran out waters on the right side. So from the front portion of the temple, by the threshold of the door, by the right side, by the altar, is going to stand in front of the temple, the millennial river is going to burst forth. It's going to come from the ground. First, it's leading. It's going to pass the eastern gate, and that's going to head south, east to the Dead Sea. It's going to go through Jerusalem first, though, because that's what our passage described, going through Jerusalem. And our passage again says, and it shall come to pass in that day that living waters shall go out from Jerusalem, half of them towards the eastern sea, half of them towards the western sea. In summer and in winter it shall be. Now, they're initially going to flow to the east, and it's clear they're going to flow southward from the temple to the city. And there it's going to divide into two branches, the western branch, which is going to go out to the Mediterranean, and the eastern branch is going to flow to the Dead Sea. It's going to provide nourishment for the farming areas that we haven't talked about on that millennial mountain. Now, I put a chart that I drew a while back in your notes there, that the millennial mountain is 50 square miles. It's the highest mountain, or will be the highest mountain in the world. And we can see that little red dot, or little red square at the top there, is my depiction. I'm not a great artist, but my depiction of the temple. The temple itself is going to be 1 mile square. Now just think of that, 1 mile square. You can picture something that's a mile away. That's only one side. And then another side, three more sides. A mile square. So this water is going to gush forth from there. It's going to go down to the... it's going to go actually around the area where the Levites are going to live. That block line there across it, that's where the Levites are going to live. And in the top section, or the northernmost section there, we've got two areas. We've got the living area for the priests on the left side, and we've got a special area for the sons of Zadok. Zadok was a family, a man and his family, that were part of the priesthood. And when the priest turned against Jehovah, Zadok said, "No, we are not doing it. We're not following you guys." And Zadok is getting a special blessing here for the entire millennial kingdom. to be separated out from the rest of the Kohanim, the priests, and have his own spot with his own family and his own group. Now, it shows you that if you follow God, there's blessings. If you follow God, there's blessings in everything you do. The closer you model your life to the scriptures, the more blessings you're going to have. I can't tell you what those blessings will be or how God will do that, but He will bless you. Adherence to His law and what He has said provides blessing. It's just that simple. Now, that river is going to branch out in Jerusalem. And look at Jerusalem there. I've depicted that as a green square, which is 10 miles square. It branches out from there, and it goes through the two farming communities that are 25 miles by 10 miles. And they are going to produce an incredible amount of food. Incredible amount of food. And then it's going to go out and empty into the Dead Sea, where there will be even more food from the fish that are going to now be there that aren't there now. And also out to the Mediterranean Sea, where we're going to get the same thing. So the eastern branch empties into the Dead Sea. The character is going to change. And it's going to begin to swarm with life. Swarm with life. Not just some additional fish. There's no fish there now. And it's going to be swarming, teeming. Ezekiel 47, verses 8 to 10 says, "Then said he unto me, these waters issue forth towards the eastern region and shall go down into the Arabah. And they shall go towards the sea. Into the sea shall the waters go, which were made to issue forth, and the waters shall be healed." Meaning the salt water in the Dead Sea is going to be healed. "And it shall come to pass that every living creature which swarmeth in every place whither the rivers come shall live. And there shall be a very great multitude of fish, for these waters are come thither, and the waters of the sea shall be healed, and everything shall live whithersoever the river cometh. And it shall come to pass that fishers will stand by it from Engedi even unto Engleim shall be a place for the spreading of nets. Their fish shall be after their kinds as the fish of the great sea, exceeding many." Now the only brackish water that's going to lift or salt water is going to be in the marshes around it. The Dead Sea is going to be sweet water, fresh water. In the Middle East, sweet water is what they call fresh water. It is highly desirable. Highly desirable because it's just not readily available. It is in Israel. Israel's a free economy and they produce a lot of wells and so on. The Arab countries, which are not quite as well advanced, they're trying things like desalinization, which is really expensive. But sweet water is highly desirable. So this passage is speaking of something that is just like gold. Drinkable water, and it's going to be in the Dead Sea, and it's going to produce an abundance of fish. Now, the last section of the passage that we started with that I think is probably the most important is that Jesus is going to be the King of the earth. The text reads in Zechariah 14:9, "And Jehovah shall be king over all the earth. In that day shall Jehovah be one and his name one." What I'm going to do is take you through a series of verses in the Old Testament that affirmed that Christ would be on David's throne. I'll show you what the Davidic covenant says. The Davidic covenant had four eternal promises: an eternal dynasty, an eternal throne, an eternal kingdom, and one eternal person. And casual reading of these verses, you just blow right past this stuff because you got to take these things apart and do it slowly. The dynasty became eternal because it culminated in one person who is eternal, Jesus the Messiah. Therefore, the throne and the kingdom are going to be eternal too, even though they're stated clearly in the text that we're going to look at, that they are eternal. Now, Jesus has not sat on that throne yet. Right now, he's seated at the right hand of God the Father in the heavens. He's not here. The fulfillment of the reestablishment of David's throne over the kingdom of Israel is yet future. We don't have a kingdom of Israel. It's going to be realized in the Messianic kingdom after Christ comes back. I'm going to take you through the six aspects of the covenant, and we're going to go in logical progression to Jesus, who is the eternal one. So the Lord promised David an eternal throne, eternal house, eternal kingdom, and it pointed to Jesus as the one who's going to establish this. The kingdom and the throne are forever because Jesus is eternal. So we follow the logic here from David down to Messiah ruling the world, where it starts with 2 Samuel chapter 7, verses 11 and 16, and it said, "And the Lord telleth thee that he will make thee a house, and thine house and thy kingdom shall be established forever. Before thee, thy throne shall be established forever." That's not hyperbole. The throne of David, he was the second of the united monarchy kings of Israel, is going to be established forever. 1 Chronicles 17:10. "And since the time that I commanded judges to be over my people Israel, moreover, I will subdue all thine enemies. Furthermore, I tell thee that the Lord will build thee a house." The Lord will build thee a house. And the house in the Old Testament has two references. You know, you can talk about the house of Saud, which is one of the Saudi kings. You can talk about the house of Tudor, one of the English kings. You're talking about a family, a dynasty, a group, a governmental body, if you will, a ruling entity. And it also talks about God's house, the temple. So it refers in two different things here. And after David's reign, Solomon ascended to the throne. He was chosen to be the successor king to David. 2 Samuel 7:12. "And when thy days," meaning to David, "be fulfilled, and thou shalt sleep with thy fathers, I will set up thy seed after thee, which shall proceed out of thy bowels, and I will establish his kingdom." Now, the next stage of this is Solomon is going to be the one that's going to build the house. David wanted to build a temple, and God says, no, Solomon's going to build it. 2 Samuel 7:13. "He shall build a house for my name." But it's going to be the Lord who's going to establish forever the throne of David, his kingdom, and his descendants, the person of Jesus. That's the house of David. The house of David is his family, his lineage, his governmental body, his status in the theocracy. Look at 2 Samuel 7:13. "He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom." Now, the shift here is changing. His kingdom forever. That's Jesus. That is Jesus. His kingdom forever. "And thine house and thine kingdom shall be established forever before thee. Thy throne shall be established forever." The use of forever, repeatedly, forever, forever, forever. It's not hyperbole. He's talking about something that's everlasting, and Jesus is everlasting. David will be resurrected. David will be back. David will be helping to rule the millennial kingdom under Jesus. He's going to be running the Jewish side of the government. And we'll look at some of those in a couple of weeks, org charts and how things are divided up. But God would disciplined Solomon for disobedience, but that does not negate the promises to David and Solomon. He sinned. Solomon turned out to be a pretty bad guy. I mean, he wasn't horribly in defiance of the Lord. He just sunk into sexual deviancy and all kinds of crazy things. He had way, way, way too much money, way, way, way too many women, way too many horses, and it just drew him away from God. Look at 2 Samuel 7:14 says, I will be his father and he shall be my son. Now he's talking about Solomon now. If he commit iniquity, I will chasten him with the rod of men and with the stripes of the children of men. But my mercy shall not depart from him as I took it from Saul, whom I put away before thee. So David's throne, his house, his kingdom are all going to be established forever through Jesus, the Messiah, who's the son of David. That's one of Jesus' titles. It's a messianic title, the son of David. 1 Chronicles 17:12 says, he shall build me a house and I will establish his throne forever. I will be his father, he shall be my son, and I will not take my mercy away from him as I took it from that was before thee, but I will settle him in mine house and in mine kingdom forever, and his throne shall be established forever. The throne of David is established forever. That's the essence of the Davidic covenant. And the Lord Jesus has as a messianic title, the Son of David. He will sit on David's throne, this eternal throne, in the temple in Jerusalem, running the world during the millennial kingdom. Now, Isaiah 9:6, that so many have in Christmas cards, and we say at Christmas, is it pertains to this. It pertains to this. It talks about the Lord Jesus being born of a virgin, but it talks about the government being upon his shoulders. And it hasn't happened yet. Now, not, at least not so you can see it, but it will. It's going to be visible. He's going to visibly control the government on David's throne in Jerusalem during the millennial kingdom for 1,000 years. And the virgin shall give a child, for unto us a child is given. And the government shall be upon his shoulder. Amen. Let's pray.